The station that brings you a howling good time.
Howling Dog Radio.
Lock it on and crank it up.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. My name is Eric Jefferson, and we're trying something a bit different with this one. Our friend Chris McKay, whom I interviewed back in August 2020, will be joining me again in a bit. But instead of a straight-up interview, I thought we'd try something else this time. Late last year, Chris started reviewing various albums from his personal music collection, and then posting letter grades for each on social media. I loved the idea, and I thought we could take it further and do a show in which we selected five albums that each of us own, offer our respective critiques, and then discuss those back and forth a bit. Chris was a good sport and agreed to do it. So we chose five albums, most of which are from the latter half of the 1970s. One is a greatest hits compilation. With that said, here's our show that we're tentatively calling Chris and Eric Rate Some Records. Thank you, Mr. Chris McKay, for joining us.
Thanks, Eric.
And we're doing this as a joint production. I'm going to be posting it for Hound Dog Radio as a podcast. Chris, you want to tell folks about your new venture?
My brother and I have an online radio station called Aboard Music Geek Radio, which is basically a vanity radio station based around my personal collection. We're starting the station with 7,000 plus songs in rotation, where most stations have fewer than 100 or even fewer than 40. So it's all over the map over the past 100 years. It's like a mixtape exploded, basically, is the way I keep thinking of it. But we're doing some original shows as well. Not sure if this will be on there. I'll go through my brother. We'll see what happens.
Sure.
But it may well show up there, too. And if you want to check it out, it's on the Live 365 network, live365.com, or through your smart speakers. My brother tells me I don't even have one. Mm-hmm. You go to Live 365 and tell it to play Board Music Geek Radio, and allegedly it will play it. So I'll take their word.
I can vouch for your brother on that because I have an Amazon Echo, and I tried that, and it worked.
It worked? Awesome. Yeah. Do I have to go to Live 365 first?
I don't remember that. I think it took a while, but I think I actually said on Live 365. And then
okay.
A second or two. And then
yeah, I know nothing, so I trust you guys.
All right, my man. You want to get rolling with the reviews?
This is your gig. I'm just here. So tell me what we're doing.
I'm glad that you're here. So I want to give you as much flexibility as I can on this. What I was thinking we would do, though, we'll take the albums one at a time.
Okay.
Each of us can go first with their what stands out, what you like, what maybe you don't. Now, I like your letter grade thing, so I put letter grades on mine too. Do you remember your letter grades for those?
Not right offhand. Like, but I can make one up right now for most of these.
Okay. No, that's fine. You can just
And remember, my grading system did actually change.
I know, and I wanted to mention that
I was being too. Everybody said I was being too generous.
I think I was one of those people.
Were you? Yeah.
I think so.
I was like, I'm not being, it's still, and I was like, here's the rating. I explained the reason why I had it that way.
But yeah, I was one of the people I think that gave you, I gave you a polite hard time. I didn't give
you. Yeah, because I was like, if it's a 50-year-old record that's in my system, you know, I don't have enough room for anything. Just because you don't like it or you think it's better or worse, I'm not going to have it if it doesn't have some value to me, because I got to make room for something that I do need to have.
Right.
I need to have a hell of a lot of records.
That brings me to this thing is that, each of us, you take a turn, then I'll take a turn. I'll say, my piece about that record, I'll give it a grade. I highlighted standout tracks that I want to mention. And then if we want to just kind of banter back and forth about anything that either said, obviously record reviews are totally subjective.
Of course.
So nobody's right or wrong. However you feel about it, it's how you feel about it.
Well, I'm sure if anybody does listening, I'm sure plenty of people think we're either or both of us are wrong about plenty. But that's fine.
But that's the beauty of stuff like this, is that everybody has their own take on it, their own way to do it. All right, so let's kick it off with our first album.
Album number one.
Elvis Costello, My Aim Is True. And tell me your thoughts on this.
My thoughts on My Aim Is True are not necessarily the thoughts of a lot of my friends who are huge Elvis Costello fans. I actually prefer My Aim Is True to this year's Model, which is controversial enough among my friends because the Attractions are not on this album.
That's right.
And of course, the fact that Huey Lewis's backup band is basically the band on this, which shows at the beginning, Welcome to the Working Week, which is the first song, you can hear those Huey Lewis and the News harmonies in the background, even, which I find kind of funny. What I like about My Aim Is True is that there's the subtle kind of soul feel to a lot of the music, which Elvis didn't really have with the Attractions. It was way more mechanical, and it was cool in its own way. But there was something that was way more soulful in the backing on these songs, which to me opened up a song like Allison a lot more. And I think it has a lot more fluidity and openness than it would have had with the Attractions doing it, to be honest with you. But then they could do something like Mystery Dance, which Elvis could have done, and jump around that way. For me, the album is successful with songs like Welcome to the Working Week, Allison. Obviously, I have the American version of the vinyl album that I went by, which ends with Watching the Detectives. The original didn't have that. Great song, belongs on there, but you can tell it's a bit of a different style too. And you know, Angel, the side two is even better. Angels Want to Wear My Red Shoes, Less Than Zero, Mystery Dance. All of those are great, and Waiting for the End of the World is a great song. Then there are the songs that I never remember. I've been hearing them for decades. Miracle Man, I never remember. No Dancing, I never remember. Blame It on Kane, I never remember. Sneaky Feelings, I never remember. Pay It Back, I never remember. I'm Not Angry, I kind of remember. So to me, it's like a 50-50 thing, and you come down to the level of there's nothing wrong with any of the songs that don't really stick with me. Mm-hmm. They just don't register to me like the other ones, but the other ones are strong enough and a strong enough opening statement that pushes the overall value of the record to a much clearer space for me. And I guess with the exception of Allison and Watching the Detectives, there isn't anything that most people would consider something that you have to have by Elvis Costello. I disagree. I love Less Than Zero. There's such cool, weird, it's almost awkward, but still soulful.
Yeah.
Which I guess is the difference between Elvis and his band,
mm-hmm.
that push and pull. It's a good feeling record that I think doesn't sound like 1977, at least in America. You know, the Stiff Records thing, the songs were basically written for Dave Edmunds because they wanted him to just be a songwriter for Dave Edmunds, and he didn't want to do that. But I have always wondered if we'd be talking about this record now if Elvis Presley hadn't died, because when it came out, it bombed.
Yeah.
Hard. And then Elvis died, 3 months later, 4 months later. And all of a sudden this guy says Elvis is king on his record. And who is this guy to try to claim the throne? And he got all this news coverage.
I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah. So now all of a sudden Elvis Costello is being talked about as this brash, young, angry Brit who dares to defile the throne of Elvis Presley.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, however many years later, what are we, 44 years later, we're still talking about it.
Yeah. I'd forgotten all about that. You're right. I mean,
I just have to wonder. I mean, he probably would have come through and done something. I just don't know if it would have been this bolt like it kind of wound up being.
Interesting.
That's all I got to say overall. If you want me to give some letter grade, I can do that too, but
yeah,
I don't know how you want to format it. So that was just me blabbing.
Well, just off the top of your head, go ahead and give it a letter grade.
With my current grading system, okay, I'd probably give it a B+.
Okay.
So I will give the album a B+.
Chris is on record, B+. All right.
Yes.
All right. Well, I was later to get into Elvis Costello than most people, probably even you. As a kid, I remember hearing of him. I guess maybe because of what you just said about the buzz, the Elvis is King thing. Yeah. I didn't piece that all together until you just said it. But I'd seen some magazine write-ups, People Magazine or whatever, about Elvis Costello, and it may have been that. And I remember thinking, I'd never heard of anybody else other than Elvis Presley use that name. So that was interesting. That was intriguing. And also, his voice just didn't work for me when I was younger, which felt like right. I had to warm up to that. At the time, I just thought it was too nasally. It just didn't work for me. And then fast forward a few years to the dawn of MTV. They played heavy rotations of Pump It Up, Oliver's Army, Accidents Will Happen, which are all in later albums. But that's where I discovered him kind of anew.
Right.
And then eventually I got on board with, okay, I like this guy. I like a lot of his music. But back to the debut album, like you said, it's not the Attractions. They were known as Clover back then from San Francisco. Right. And you can tell it's not the Attractions on there. And like you said, a lot of hardcore fans were very quick to tell you that it's not the Attractions on there.
And I say that's a good thing, personally.
It is. Well, it's Yeah, I don't know if it's good or bad, but it's different, and I like different sometimes. I like that. I like a lot of the straight ahead style that they use on the album that they play with. Also, with Elvis Costello, particularly on this album, he really shows his affinity for 50s kind of doo-wop sound, or like that, even that Bebop-a-Lula type rock and roll mystery dance makes me think of that.
Yeah, but it makes me think of Jailhouse Rock to the da-na-na.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then there's other stuff like Blame It on Kane and Pay It Back, which are like more fun bar band kind of style numbers.
Definitely.
Yeah. But then you get into like Allison. You mentioned Allison. That's one I struggled with when reviewing this album, because I know part of your condition for your album reviews, and I like this, is that you tried to listen as best you could as if you hadn't heard these songs for years.
That's the only honest way to judge, and right. It's really hard.
It is. It's very. Yeah, that's why I said I struggled with that. But I like that idea, because particularly with, say, Allison, I come into it with the prejudices of I've heard this song on the radio for 40 odd years, and you know, and I personally don't need to ever hear it again. But that doesn't make it a bad song just because commercial radio has beat it into my head for decades. So I had to try to turn that off as best I could and just listen to the song just as it stands on its own. I got better at it as I went through. It's unmistakably a fine song. And the kind of the sparseness of the production I really like on it.
Yeah.
And there's no melodrama. It's a ballad, but it's not a melodramatic ballad, at least the way he delivers it. It's he even says, I'm not going to get too sentimental, but he doesn't play it that way. He just kind of says it matter of factly. Yeah. Whereas like later ballads, especially in the bands that came around in the 80s, everything was just bombastic and over the top with the ballad, but he doesn't go that way here. There's no melancholy caterwaul or anything like that. It's just a guy, matter of factly, lamenting on the one who got away. And like, he's even talking to her specifically. He's just not being ridiculous about it.
And it's really dry.
It's
really dry and honest, which is great.
And you mentioned Less Than Zero. That's one of my favorite tracks as well.
Yeah. It's just a cool groove. It starts with the twist and shout groove.
Yeah. I can see because that was the date. That was the first single, if I remember.
You're right.
Double check. But it didn't do well. And because I guess for various reasons, it was just so different. And then when he did, you probably know about this, he performed on Saturday Night Live, went into that, and then realized that that wasn't right for the room, I guess, and called the audible. That got him banned from Saturday Night Live for a number of years by doing that. They went into radio, which I don't know if anybody'd even heard yet.
Right.
But I personally am a fan of Less Than Zero. I love the lyrics to it, the historical heft to the lyrics. And then the story of how it came to it, that the pre-World War II fascist that he's speaking about on there, who later in life tried to save face to the British press. And Costello wasn't having any of that, and I could respect that certainly.
Yeah,
and I know you can too.
Elvis has got some questionable things in his history for sure.
Well, yeah, but he was young then too, and
I know I was
probably a little bit more idealistic, shall we say? I don't know. And then the next release, This Year's Model, that's when the Attractions came aboard. So it was a different band, different style, but. I'm with you, man. I'm a fan of this album. My Aim Is True. And I know the Costello fans maybe slightly somewhat dismiss it in favor of the later ones, but I'll listen to this album any day of the week. I really enjoy it. I gave it an A. I gave it a flat out A.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's good. And see, that's where I'm like, huh, did I misgrade? But no, I'm trying
no.
to still, A for me.
Yeah.
I have to really like every song.
Yeah.
A plus has to be perfect.
I haven't given anything an A plus yet for that same reason.
Yeah.
This one, I guess why I teetered between B plus and A with this, I went with the A because I find every track completely listenable. Now, some I like more than others. Some are obviously stronger than others, but it's one of those albums that I could put on and just walk away from and not skip anything.
Yes, and I agree with you on that. The only difference in my opinion is that about half of the album, if the songs disappeared from the face of the earth, I wouldn't really miss them that much.
Well, and that's fair.
They're good to listen to, and that's my only argument. But about half of the album is like, no, you can't get rid of that song. We need that song.
Yeah.
So that's the difference.
When you say that, it makes me think of something else that I guess if we ever do any reviews of 80s records, when it seemed like especially the early 80s, where the sequencing was always done to up front, put all the A material right on that first side, right out of the gate. And then the second side would just kind of be a no man's land a lot of times. But this, the standout tracks are sprinkled throughout. And I appreciate that.
It's an album.
Yeah. And that's what an album should be. It's not front loaded.
That's not necessarily what a collection of songs is, but that's what an album should be.
But a lot of time, only a few years later, it seemed like that the trend was to always front load the best stuff right out of the gate. I guess maybe because there's kind of an unwritten joke or rule or whatever that said that critics, at least back then, would listen to the first three songs and base the review off that. I don't know how true that was. That probably varied from critic to critic. But
as somebody that, I don't know if you ever did actual critiquing or writing. I was a music writer and reviewer.
I know you were, yeah.
And you're going to get pretty bogged in by the third song.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, they have to undo. You understand what I'm saying? So it's like, out a certain way, you're not going to be able to just have the fourth through the 10th song be a completely different thing.
Okay.
Because you're going to already see something particular and it's going to be all framed and everything else is going to be slanted by what you originally saw. So it is tough.
Yeah. So what you're saying is, well, and I have done some reviews and probably not to the level you have, but you're saying that by the third song, you're already somewhat formed your basis for your.
Well, yeah, especially if you do it all the time, you're not just doing it as a fan. And this is something that you're doing because you're hearing. It's like you're the whole point is to kind of format your ideas in mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's potentially 15 minutes into a record.
Yeah.
You're going to have some opinions by then.
Of course.
Whether I like this or not, you're going to be like, man, this is great. Or please let this get better. Yeah. Or please just end this.
But as a fan, you have the opposite where it's say Journey Escape. I'm throwing that out there.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I don't need the second side of Journey Escape at all. I know Open Arms Close is the album, but the other songs just are so forgettable to me.
I can't remember what's on side two, right? But Open Arms I can certainly do without. Escape is on side two, right? I like Escape. Lay It Down's all right.
Yeah.
Better Alive, I really like. The hard rock song.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we could do another one that we could add that to the list.
But yeah, Don't Stop Believing, Stone in Love.
Who's Crying Now?
Keep On Running. Still Let Ride.
Still Let Ride. I mean, yeah, that's a fabulous side, in my opinion.
But as far as I'm concerned, you could throw off Keep On Running because that sounds like that's the Jefferson Starship song from that side.
That's the weak link in the chain. And Frontiers, they did the same thing with
Frontiers. Messed up because they gave so many songs to soundtracks.
Yeah.
That were written for the album. Frontiers could have been a monster.
Only the Young should have damn well been on that.
Oh, of course. What else was Only Solution? Wasn't that one from Tron or something? Ask the Lonely.
Because they put that on the greatest hits a few years later, but it was recorded for Frontiers.
But that's what I'm saying. And I think it was in another movie. And I think they screwed themselves on that one.
Yeah.
I think, wasn't even Be Good to Yourself held back?
I thought that was on Raised on Radio, or maybe did they record it for Frontiers and then just put it out?
It was Only the Young.
Yeah.
Only the Young was recorded, I think, and then they held it for Vision Quest.
Exactly. Yeah, and then they put it on their greatest hits eventually, but yeah, damn well should have been on Frontiers. I agree.
Imagine Frontiers with all of those songs added in, and it's you can't argue it. You can say I don't like it, but you can't argue it as being a great album of what it would be.
Oh no, I completely agree with that. Everything you just said.
So anyway, that's not our conversation.
No, but it's a good conversation.
Album number two.
I'll give you preference here. What do you want to do next?
I don't know. Maybe I should shuffle them like cards.
Just randomly pick one.
Yeah, I don't know what it's going to do. Presence.
I'm glad you said that because that's the one I have ready right here.
There you go. With somebody named Zorn's name written across the top of my used record that a friend gave me.
Now, full.
You're not listening through with records, are you?
Yeah, I did for a live too.
Yeah, because to me, I mean, you can't.
I was just about to bring this up. Is that
it's a different record with the whole
full disclosure? Is that I know that you're listening exclusively with vinyl, I respect that. I am trying to as best I can. If I have the vinyl, of course, that's how I'm going to listen to it. However, if I don't have it, just for our purposes, I'm not going to run out and buy it.
Fortunately, you're choosing from records that I already have. So
yes, well, I have your list. So yeah,
right. That's what I mean. Those are records I have.
So I'm going from the next best option, which would be CD. But you're right, and that they it could be a different listening experience.
It is to me. Apparently, it's not to everyone.
I go back and forth with that. Because I could see arguments each way.
There's a lot of albums. Somebody was just talking about The Wall I saw on social media, and like, I just don't get it. And then another guy was like, you got to listen to the record where you can where it stops, because it's like movements.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you have each section of the movie,
yeah,
and then you take a break, and it does make a difference. There's a lot of records where it matters. And Achilles, you know, Nobody's Fault But Mine, that's a beginning. It's side two.
Yeah.
You know, both sides fade in.
I did do that for our purposes, because I'm trying to emulate your listening environment as best I could, is that I did stop and for a while and did something else. I can't remember what.
Yeah,
and then picked it back up with Nobody's Fault But Mine. But I know the record so well that I'm not sure how I really needed to do that, but I'm trying to play by the rules here.
Yes.
All right.
Not that there are any rules, but play by them anyway.
Well, you had established them for yourself. I'm just trying to follow your lead as best I can.
Okay.
But like you, I guess what you're implying is nothing's etched in stone here.
Of course not. Absolutely not.
All
right. If it was, I'd want a sledgehammer.
Led Zeppelin Presence. You want to take this one first, or you want me to go first?
Well, your turn. Go ahead.
Well, Presence, as you know, it's I don't know if you probably would agree with this, but tell me if you don't. I think it's the most overlooked album in Zeppelin's entire discography. I'll let you talk.
I'll weigh in when it's my turn.
Okay. I don't think it gets as much attention, or just historically hasn't gotten as much attention as obviously the first four, then Physical Graffiti, Houses of the Holy, of course, before that, and even In Through the Outdoor, because it was the last one before things yeah, kind of disintegrated. So I think it's overlooked a lot, and I think it's somewhat underappreciated. I know it was recorded at a difficult time for the band, especially for Robert Plant.
Right.
Because of his accident, folks don't know that Robert Plant recorded the majority, if not the entirety, of the vocals sitting in a wheelchair. At least that's what the legend has it.
Yeah.
So there are times where I feel like the album itself, it shows the strain of what they were going through at the time, particularly Plant. On the positive side, I have to say this up front, Achilles' Last Stand, and we've talked about this unofficially before, that's always a top five Led Zeppelin track for me.
That's a top one song for me.
Really? It's number one for you?
That's my favorite Zeppelin song.
Okay. Well, it's always in my top five. My top five may change depending on what day you ask me, at least the order, the sequence of it.
Yeah.
But the songs generally are probably about the same. That's always in the mix.
And Zeppelin, as cliche as it is one of my all-time favorite bands. So for that to be my favorite song by them is a big deal.
That says a lot. I agree. Yeah. I just love everything about it. John Bonham takes center stage on this one. Just his drum work is just spectacular on this track. The album itself, he really shines on this album. He always does, but for whatever reason, he seems like he was just on a tear just for this particular record. And nothing exemplifies that more than the first track, in my opinion. He does that. He's time shifting. He's doing all kinds of stuff. I think it actually was probably, I'm going to go as far as to say, and feel free to refute me on this, is that it was probably a major influence on a lot of the British metal bands that came later. Was the kind of playing that he does on this. That's just my theory. I'm basing that on absolutely nothing.
I could see that with the galloping. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Galloping. Okay. That's yeah. All right. But the entire track is just magnificent. And it feels like it takes the listener on this epic, expansive journey. And I'm always up for that ride for this song. I love it. Definitely top five. Chris says it's top one for him. That's a strong statement. I like that. The next two songs, I start to notice Plant's vocal limitations at the time on For Your Life and Royal Orleans. However, he was constrained. I don't dislike either track, but they probably move me the least of the bunch on Presence. And I'll explain when I get to that a little bit on that. I don't find anything unlistenable in Presence. I don't know about you, but when you get to your review, I'll find out. But I don't find, and I know we probably slightly disagree on this, there's no hats off to Roy Harper on this album. There's nothing that I just can't handle. I can listen to this front to back, this whole album. But there are obviously songs that I feel are lesser than the sum of its parts. And you mentioned Nobody's Fault But Mine earlier in our discussion. That's one I always remember hearing on the radio a lot. Growing up in Philadelphia, they played the hell out of that song.
Wow.
And I also hear Plant's vocal strained a bit on that. Or maybe it's just I'm looking for it. I don't know, for purposes of this record. But I always thought it even years ago that he seemed like he wasn't quite in top form. And for understandably so. I completely get it. But that pounding rhythm section on that and that the harmonica solo. I love the harmonica solo in Nobody's Fault But Mine.
I say that's where Robert Plant is underrated. Nobody ever talks about his harmonica playing.
I don't know if I've ever talked about his harmonica playing, but it really, really works well on this track. I love it. And I love the stop and start, the whole arrangement to it. Good stuff by me. Then you get to Candy Store Rock, that 50s boogie kind of sound that shows how much they were influenced by the Elvis, Buddy Holly kind of era rockabilly. I personally, this is just me, and I'm just some guy sitting here in 2021. Well, I don't know if I would have released that as a single, but they did. I would have gone for the next track, Hot Song for Nowhere, which I know that some Zeppelin fans dismiss, but I've always been a fan of it. I think it's catchy. I think it worked well, would have worked well as a radio single. I know it's a little fluffy by Zeppelin standards, unless you really take a look at the lyrics. But it's a fun track for an album that doesn't have a lot of fun on it, for better or worse. It's a fun song, and I think it would have made a decent single. You know, I'm not top 10, but it would have maybe cracked the top 40. That's just my opinion. And then the album closes on T for One, which is kind of like it harkens back to Since I've Been Loving You, but that slow blues crawl.
Yeah.
It's kind of it sounds like it's almost a metaphor for the entire album. Well, it's not maybe up to the level of some of its predecessors, but judged on its own merits, it's a fine piece of work. I gave this one a B. That's my letter grade for presence. And I put standout tracks as Achilles' Last Stand, Nobody's Fault, and a Hot Song for Nowhere. The floor is yours.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about my own letter grade for this because that's I'll just talk about the record and then I'll see if
an answer can. Yo, it'll come to you.
Basically, we agree on Achilles' Last Stand. I might go a little bit further with it. I think it's certainly Bonham's work on that is probably the best in his career as far as I'm concerned, but you can't underestimate Page with his layering.
Oh yeah.
Just the fact that the song, there's really not anything prior to this that sounds like that. And Led Zeppelin were the greatest at stealing.
Oh yeah.
They would steal in a minute and credit themselves and blah, blah, blah. I mean, Nobody's Fault But Mine.
That's a fine example.
The Page Plant
on
this album. And it ain't Page Plant.
Right.
But Achilles' Last Stand is for me the peak of that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't like it. I've heard some people say it was Disco Zeppelin, which I find kind of hysterical. What? Yeah, just because but it's not to me. No, I don't get that.
No, I can't even.
Now it's got a little funk, but that's a very different beast. And that gallop that you're talking about, I could certainly hear it coming out in a lot of Maiden in specific comes to mind with that kind of gallop. But which I hadn't thought of before, which is quite likely. Mm-hmm. I just think it's a great song. It's the perfect apex of Plant's Middle Eastern by way of Valhalla and Wales mythology, where he mixes all that together into this whole thing of Atlas Mountains and this and that and the other. So it just works. Mm-hmm. Oh, via Greece too in this case because Achilles. But it's just a really strong song for all of the 10 minutes. It never loses me. The layering in it. And I had heard that Jimmy Page recorded like all of his parts in one night or something.
I've heard like marathon all night sessions.
Yeah. Where he was just probably coked up, to be honest with you, and just doing what he had to do, but he got the work done and it was something special. So to me, I can't grade presence at all without Achilles' Last Stand.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that song was important enough to me that that's the album. Now, that being said, For Your Life, I'm cool with it. I think it's a really interesting riff. It's almost like a pastiche of Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Doing themselves. It's like they were imitating themselves almost on this one. But it sounds really good. It's good. It fittingly deals with cocaine as well.
Sure.
So, yeah. And that's what the whole song is about, is the dangers of that. What's up after that? Royal Orleans. don't care. Notice that that song is credited to all of the guys in the band.
Yeah.
And that was just them kind of making fun of each other for the kissing whiskers thing, where whatever, John Paul Jones woke up after being with a drag queen and not realizing it or something.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and they're kind of dogging Jonesy on that, because apparently he wasn't the type to do that. And apparently he wasn't having an affair, but this other man was flirting with him and he didn't even realize it was a man. Uh-huh. So they thought that was funny, and they were New Orleans, Royal Orleans. It's exactly what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. So that's that. I don't care about that song one way or the other. Nobody's Fault But Mine is a great muscular rock song. Mm-hmm. When you speak about Plant's vocal limitations, I think a lot of that is more what he says, like for Kashmir from Physical Graffiti. He says that the song intimidated him.
Okay.
And he said he never felt like he caught it in the studio. And he said every performance he's ever sung it live, he got it better because he was so intimidated by the song. So I wonder if some of that comes into play here as well. Yeah. You know, his harmonica playing is always stellar.
Yeah.
And there's a thing with his harmonica playing in Mick Jagger's, which nobody ever talks about either. Mm-hmm. It's this really dirty, gnarly, you know, ugly sound that works perfectly.
I've heard Jagger get accolades for his harmonica, but you were completely dead on in that Plant rarely, if ever, does.
I've not heard much of any from either of them. And having seen, you know, Plant play Nobody's Fault But Mine and break that thing out, it's like your hair blows back. Mm-hmm. You hear it coming through speakers. It's like, geez, man, what is this? So Nobody's Fault But Mine has that, and it has that groove and the stop and start thing, which can get irritating for me. The song could have been cut down a little bit, which I won't usually say with the Zeppelin thing, mm-hmm. but I love the track. And again, it comes down to Page for me. His textures and his tones. And of course, Page leads you to have Bonham doing what Bonham does. Now, this album overall may be the least important one for Jones, who is so vital on all the other records, but he's mm-hmm. he almost seems like he's missing an action here creatively,
right,
compared to what he usually is.
Yeah, there's no Jimmy Page record.
There's no keyboard.
Yeah.
There's no, and it's the only one with no keyboard.
Yeah. And then the next one, of course, would be keyboard heavy.
Right. Because Page was in his smack days.
Right, exactly.
Pretty wasted. But yeah, okay, side two, Nobody's Fault But Mine. Candy Store Rock, you like it. I do not like it.
I do.
And in fact, it was one of the first Zeppelin songs I ever heard.
Really? No, that's
when I was a kid and I did not like it.
Yeah.
So it made me judge them because I was hearing mid-70s stuff and I was like, what is this? Do they think they're Elvis?
Yeah.
Well, but I actually think that's why they released as a single, perhaps even.
I do like it, but I do question as to why they released it as a single, because I would not have done that.
Well, because it was long enough to release as a single was probably the main reason.
Yeah, that's my critique on it, is that I think it's a serviceable album track, but it's not a single.
Hot Song for Nowhere to me is pre Van Halen.
Okay. That never occurred to me 1 second, but I can see where you're going.
And I saw something recently that Van Halen actually covered it.
Okay. I'm not surprised.
So it was clearly an influence on them. I do like that song. It's got a weird groove. I don't know if I'd go so far to say anything on the record is fun, except for maybe Candy Store Rock. But that's just got a fun, smooth groove.
Yeah.
Where it didn't sound like they were taking themselves seriously. T for One ends the record. And T for One it's a rewrite of Since I've Been Loving You.
Of course it is.
But it's a damn good rewrite of Since I've Been Loving You. If Since I've Been Loving You didn't exist, this would be the one that you go to.
Right.
And at least this time, Plant didn't steal verbatim the lyrics to Moby Grape's Never, which is the lyrics to Since I've Been Loving You. So it's got that going for it. And of course, you got that weird time shift at the beginning where you're in this, you know, one mood and then it totally slides, then suddenly slams into that really slowed down thing.
Yeah. Like it's ominous. It has that ominous. Yeah.
Yeah. And I know Page and Plant tried to do that song and on the first big tour that they did. And the drummer who was great, that was playing with them, then they keep screwing up. There's a YouTube video of them trying to play it in Japan, I think.
Oh, really?
Every time it goes to the transition to slow down, it's rough. So, which just goes to show. Overall, it's a solid record. I don't think it's overlooked, which is, you're accurate to say, its highs are high enough that it should still be regarded among the other records as being as good. To me, it's probably the least consistent to that point, which I would have to say, as much as I love the highs of it. And I'm trying to think of my rule is, if some of the songs were disappeared from the face of the earth, would I cry over them? There's several, like Candy Star Rock, I wouldn't care if I ever heard again. Royal Orleans, don't care. But the rest, I wouldn't want to lose. So I would probably, it's tough. I think I'm probably going to wind up with a B+ on this one as well.
Okay.
simply because it's the same thing where it's about half and half I can't get rid of, and half the stuff is so good. And of course, with this, if I'm just taking Achilles Last Stand alone, I would rank this album then higher than My Aim Is True. But as an album,
yeah,
I'm going to rank it give or take even. And that's interesting because both of those records were basically from within a year of each other.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, I guess Presence came out a few months earlier. So it was very close.
Right.
And if you think about Elvis Costello being the antithesis of these dinosaur bands. Yeah. So that's that. And that's where I am on that.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Album number 3.
Well, all B pluses all the time. That's going to be my trademark.
So you've been steady B pluses so far. I gave an A and a B, so I'm bouncing back and forth. You're consistent so far.
Well, it's not me. It's the records that allegedly are consistent. Allegedly.
Yeah. Album number 3, Neil Young and Crazy Horse. That's important. Russ Never Sleeps.
Neil Young and Crazy Horse, which is important, even though the first side is a concert. So, yes, but it still absolutely matters. I'm trying to compare this to some of the other albums in my mind, because I think a lot of Neil's albums are overrated.
Okay. Well, as a standalone record.
Yeah. Well, I know, but I have to, for some reason, I have to think of that. This one I think is rated about right.
Okay.
It's a solid record. It's a good rock record. It's neither of the 70s or the 80s. It's kind of a bridge from what he had done for what he was doing. If I'm looking at the track list on this vinyl thing here, obviously the acoustic version, the My My Hey Hey, ultimately it's a throwaway. It's a nice album opener and bookend.
Yeah.
You don't need it. In his career, you don't need that version of it. Thrasher, it doesn't stick with me very often.
Really? Okay.
It's okay. I like it. Ride My Llama, same thing. I don't find myself humming it.
Hmm.
Pocahontas, I think, is brilliant.
Yeah.
This is where I do the name dropping thing, of course. I when I saw Neil the first time, it was at a Farm Aid.
Yeah.
And with Willie, and he sang it with he changed Marlon Brando to Willie Nelson. So whenever I hear the song, I always hear him saying Willie Nelson and me, and it just brings me back to a nice moment. Sail Away, again, I kind of lose. And I actually think Side Two is way stronger. And that's basically because of the three quarters of the songs. You're talking about Powderfinger, you know, which was written for Skynyrd, and they never got to do.
Right.
Welfare Mothers is, come on, it's an asinine song, but it's fun. Stand Delivery, neither here nor there for me. And of course, Hey, Hey, My, My, End of the Black. It's hard to hear it again for the first time.
Exactly.
After it being burned into your mind. But when you think about, if you can get yourself in a place that you've never heard the song before ever, And imagine, you know, if you'd never heard it in or hearing it, how it affects you, especially once again, same era, even though it came out a little bit later in 79, with him referencing the death of Elvis, you know, that was everything. And, you know, 77, 78, the, where are we now? You know, the king is gone, but not forgotten. And then comparing him to Johnny Rotten.
Yeah.
I was pretty punk. And of course, I think the original version of the Hey, Hey, My, My was done with Devo, because I think he wrote that for Devo.
I did not know that.
Think about that one.
Yeah, I knew about the Skynyrd one, but I never the Powderfinger, but I never heard the.
Yeah, if you look up, you can see it online. Neil Young and Devo playing that song together.
Interesting.
From the movie Human Highway, and it's the same song, but you hear that da 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 da. When Neil does it, it sounds like Neil, but he was thinking of that really. That's what he was hearing. So I always find that interesting, and hearing it with Bougie Boy and stuff. It's a whole different experience, but I'm biased by it because I know that version as well and always have. Yeah. But overall, this one's hard. I almost want to give it an A-. So if I almost want to do it, that's what I'm going to give this one because the impact of the other song. So overall, I'm going to say it's a better album than the other two, despite the fact that one of my all-time favorite songs is on the previous album.
Okay. What would that
be? Not just to change it because I would.
Okay. You're talking about the Zeppelin album. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll preface this with saying this may be my favorite album of Neil's entire discography.
Underrated, like I said. Yeah.
I'm not sure. I do agree with you that some of his albums are overrated, slightly at least.
Come on, Harvest is incredibly overrated. It's
Harvest
it's,
is it's one a I good was record, about.
But it's scattershot and it's
and yeah. Then there are others that I think are kind of overlooked. I think Ragged Glory is a fine album.
Ragged Glory is a really strong record. Yes, I'm with you on that. And Freedom even gets overlooked.
Yeah, Ragged Glory was one of my favorite albums of the early '90s by anybody.
I can see that.
But back to this one, Rust Never Sleeps. I actually wrote down the word bookend. It's funny that you mentioned the bookends of the My Hey Hey. Then closing with just reversing the title and closing with the Crazy Horse version. It's the former, the acoustic one sounds the vulnerable and foreboding, while the album closer with Crazy Horse behind him sounds defiant. At least it comes off as defiant. Rock and roll can never die.
Right.
That's kind of a testimony to his songwriting, is that I think it works well both ways.
Oh, it does. Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, I think we disagree on Thrasher, because I'm a big fan of Thrasher. I think the lyrics to Thrasher are just wonderful.
I'll pull out my handy lyric sheet while you're talking.
Okay, no, that's great. The Thrasher, it's actually
those are great lyrics. You're right. I'm looking back over them. They are fantastic lyrics.
The threshing machine, he first uses a death symbol, and then as the words continue to unfold, the song, it kind of establishes itself as a tale of someone breaking free from what he perceives as the dead end life. You have lyrics like, it was then I knew I'd had enough, burn my credit card for fuel, headed out to where the pavement turns to sands. With a one-way ticket to the land of truth and my suitcase in my hands. How I lost my friends, I still don't understand. I think that's brilliant.
That is, you're right.
And it's almost like Thunder Road on the farm, the guy breaking out from his current state to what he hopes is a better life. But Thunder Road has the E Street Band building and building, building to the crescendo. This is just Neil, like you said, this is just acoustic. Neil grounded just him. I love that song, Thrasher. Pocahontas, I think we're much more in agreement on. I think that's another highlight of the album that has the imagery that just really works well. It starts out with the aurora borealis, the icy sky at night, but then you get the gut punch of they killed us in our teepee and they cut our women down. Yikes. The whole Native American brave witnessed the horror firsthand. It's a tough read, but it's a great song. I love that one. Powderfinger is also one that stands out to me. The fictional narrator moves it to a young man in the old West, left to guard his family's home, finds himself in a doomed situation. I actually wrote down some lyrics to that, but I can't. Oh, there they are. The daddy's rifle in my hand felt reassuring. I won't go through the whole thing, but that whole verse is
it's drive-by triggers in training.
Yeah, I agree with you on Welfare Mothers. That one takes things down a bit, more than a bit for me. I agree with you on that one. Same with Sedan Delivery. That doesn't really move me one way or the other.
Yeah, that's Sedan Delivery is definitely the throwaway for me. Well, From Others doesn't bother me. I just think it's asinine. It's just
it doesn't bother me either, but compared to the other songs that we talked about, it's lesser, definitely.
It's definitely very 1970-something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of interesting looking back now. You think this is 1979, and a lot of Neil's 60s peers, they had already had their commercial and artistic peaks by then. Whereas Neil was still on a slow burn. He was still out there making relevant music. And like I said, this is my personal favorite of his whole catalog. So to me, he kind of had the longest arc of any of like Dylan, the Stones, the Who, with Roger McGuinn, his 60s peers.
Dylan is arguable because even his newest album is considered a masterpiece.
I'm not saying they're bad.
And by the way, I don't agree with that because I heard the album. I was like, really? This? Guys, I love Dylan, but come on.
Well, I guess I'm just going for my personal opinion is that Dylan's 60s stuff is the iconic. That's where he laid the groundwork for his legend.
See what you're saying. Okay.
And Blood on the Tracks, of course, that's 70s, and that's a great album too. But Neil had the slow burn. He was constantly building and building. And then to me, this was the apex for personally, commercially. I like some of his later stuff too. I like Harvest Moon. Of course, I mentioned Ragged Glory, but this to me is my favorite Neil album. And it's also, I actually wrote this down, have a rock and roll can never die. It seemed like an anthemic statement in 1979, but in 2021, I'm not sure. I'm scared that it could, but even if it did, this album makes a hell of a historical record for when rock and roll really mattered to me. I gave this one a full on A, and I am unabashed about it.
Good.
Thrasher, Powderfinger, and I like the Hey Hey My My, the reprise, the full band one.
Well, I don't mind it. I was saying was that I th- ones on if he had a song that was more solid, I wouldn't have missed it necessarily.
That's completely.
I totally understand the bookending things. It works on quite a few albums, and the dichotomy of the two with the quiet and the rock. Yes, you were valid on all of those points. My only thing was like, I'm sure Neil had a kick-ass song sitting there somewhere that he could have also used. But yes,
he did the bookend thing. What was it, Freedom? He did it with the Rockin' in the Free World.
Oh, you're right. That's on that too. You're absolutely right. Yep.
Yeah, it's the opened with the acoustic version and then closed with the one that everybody knows. Every three chord band, including ones I've been in, have played that.
Yeah. And that was what, 1989, 1990? Yeah. And he was still...
That was 10 years after this one.
That's what I'm saying. And he was still creating songs that every band knows.
Yeah. All right, we've got two to go.
Album number 4.
Go ahead.
Let's do America's Greatest Hits.
And we're doing different versions of the album.
Right. And I will tell you this, because I researched the one that you have and I listened to this album in the as best. Well, I had all the songs, so I listened to it in the sequence that you have them on that record.
Ah, good. Because it's definitely a different record that way.
Right.
It's way different.
Yeah. And I didn't listen to. All right. I did listen to You Can Do Magic just on my own because I love it. But I listened for our purposes here. I listened to the album just as you have. Just so we could be as in sync as we can.
Good.
All right. Well, I know that, you know, America, they've been critically branded for years as quote unquote a poor man's Crosby, Stills, and Nash, which
they take as a compliment. But yeah.
Right. And, you know, it's not completely unwarranted, especially in some aspects. I think the poor man's is a slight that I could do without.
Yeah.
But I can see it, especially with tracks like I Need You. If you told me when I was younger that was actually a CSN song, I might have believed it.
Right.
Same for Sandman.
I still meet people that think A Horse With No Name is Neil.
Yeah. Or Sandman, even down to the Neil-esque guitar solo that closes it out. You know?
True, yeah.
You know, I would have bought that. If you told me when I was a kid, you know, that's Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, it sounds like them. But America did distinguish themselves with the polished and layered production that they got later on, especially. I mentioned this to you before we were recording earlier today. The song of America's that will always have a bigger place for me in my heart than any is Ventura Highway. I love Ventura Highway. It's hands down my favorite track of theirs. I'm not even going to go as far as to say it's their best song. It's just my personal favorite. I don't know if it's a childhood thing because I remember hearing it out of the AM radios back in our childhood, our respective childhoods. And I always love the guitars, just the way they just kind of, it's like a harmony guitar, especially that starts it out, the two guitars. It's just beautiful. And the way
it's weird because there's all those counter melodies, but
right.
Yeah,
No, that's fine. And the vocal on it, it's just simple. It's breezy. It's descriptive. It's descriptive, but minimally it gives me everything I need to know to put myself on this imaginary Ventura Highway, you know, California dusty stretch of road. And I mentioned the mesh dual guitars that are just, I can immerse myself in that song even to this day on every listen. I just think it's a masterful single. And I believe if it didn't hit number one, but it damn well should have.
I don't think it hit number one. I don't think they ever had a number one, but it was.
No, I think it made, 10. Yeah, it made top 10, but it's, I don't know what it was competing with. That's always important.
That's true.
When you go with the, why didn't this song ever hit number one? Well, sometimes you have to look at what was in front of it. And I don't know off the top of my head. And then there are other tracks like Only in Your Heart. I know that was pre-George Martin, right?
Well, this says History America's Greatest Hits produced by George Martin, and it's got it on there.
Okay.
So I can look and double check and see if it's got any additional notes that that's an exception.
I thought that was before Martin officially became their producer.
This looks like it says that this all produced by George Martin.
Okay.
Maybe they just didn't put the notes as well.
Okay. I guess why I bring that up is because it has that very Beatlesque part at the end. So if Martin wasn't involved, they were kind of calling his name musically for that.
Oh, wait, it's got all of the production credits. Which song are we talking about?
Only in Your Heart.
Hal Blaine on drums. I didn't know that. Remixed by George Martin.
Ah, maybe that's where we're going. Okay. Because that was the version I listened to.
Produced by America, remixed by George Martin.
Okay, because I know it was originally on the Homecoming album. That was before he was involved, but he probably put his Martin-esque touches on.
So we are both correct.
Yeah, yes. Okay. So that's interesting. Of course, Sister Golden Hair, it's another personal favorite of mine.
That's a good My Sweet Lord part two.
Yeah, some people say, "Oh, that's a guilty pleasure." I'm not guilty about it. I like the damn song, and I don't care.
I literally had a conversation yesterday or this morning about ABBA.
Yeah.
What are your guilty pleasures? It's just pleasures. I don't have any guilt.
Right. I'm not ashamed of this.
I'm happy to listen to Dancing Queen anytime.
Right. I know Martin was fully on board for tracks like Lonely People and Tin Man. So I know that was his production even from the start. Now, I think we may disagree on this. You could tell me when we turn the microphone over to you, as somebody once said, but I just can't get behind any version of Muskrat Love. I just can't. I will say that I do enjoy America's version a little more than the more famous Captain and Tennille that went to number four. That one I looked up. That went to number four in the Billboard charts. Was it 3 years later? I think America's was recorded in 73.
Yeah, give or take, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if that's clouding my judgment. It's possible. I'm trying to put on those blinders like we agreed to of just listening for the first time. I think I struggle more on Muskrat Love than anything else. Because I think just the Captain and Tennille version kind of creeps into my subconscious when I listen to it. This one, it only reached number 67, America's version. They released it as a single, but it never cracked the top 40. And I believe it's the only song on here from their Holiday album. You may correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that's the only representation they're from their Holiday album on this Greatest Hits. But I'll leave it at this, that there are some bands that I personally think to fully get a firm grasp on, you need to dig into their entire catalog. Then there are others where I think you can do that and that's fine, but a Greatest Hits can just give you a good thumbnail of what the band was all about. And I think America is in the latter category. I think a solid Greatest Hits from America gives you a lot of what they were about, what their sound was. You can dig deeper further if you want, but you don't have to fully get them, in my opinion. I gave this one a B+. Standout tracks, I wrote Ventura Highway, Lonely People, and Sister Golden Hair, which I mentioned earlier. Not guilty about that.
Yeah. and for some reason, the first thing I'm seeing here is that the artwork is done by Phil Hartman.
Yeah, that's right.
Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a major Phil Hartman fan, and I'm embarrassed that I forgot that. I'm glad you brought it to my attention.
I just saw it, and it made me laugh.
I loved Phil Hartman.
Other thing I was noticing while we were talking is that when we're talking about George Martin, it's important to also realize almost every one of these credits is engineer Jeff Emmerich.
Okay, that makes sense.
So you got George Martin and Jeff Emmerich. And for any of you that don't know, Jeff Emmerich is the one that made the Beatles record sound like the Beatles. He was the engineer that was responsible for getting those sounds. George Martin is the one that produced, ranged, mixed. Jeff Emmerich is the one that made those tones and sounds. And when they said they wanted this sound or that, Jeff's job is to make it happen. So if anybody knows how to make a record sound like the Beatles,
absolutely,
arguably even more than George, it's Jeff.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah. And they're both here on all these songs. And it's, for me, everything from this album is sepia toned in soft focus with mountains and things waving, plants waving, because that's just the sound of this record. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. There's this yellow tinted haze.
Oh, yeah. I can visualize what you're saying. Absolutely.
And if you're going in order here, like we did with some of the other ones, A Horse with No Name, hearing it fresh, it's a great song, whether you think it's a Neil Young song or whatever. It's a strange little song, but it's just a great piece of AM gold.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And that's a Bunnell. And then the next one is I Need You, which is a Beckley, which when I saw them, he gave some speech about he just wanted to write it in tribute to George Harrison. And he even used the title of the George song. So that's what that is. And that one's neither here nor there for me. It's a nice song.
Right.
Sandman is another Bunnell, and it's a weird song. I mean, Ain't It Foggy Outside? The whole vibe of it gives this creepy, the planes have all been grounded. You don't know why. So that's got one of those eerie vibes that I really like and admire. And some of that acoustic wooden music from that era. Ventura Highway, like you mentioned, perfect. Hal Blaine on drums, who did, if you don't know, that was the guy from the Wrecking Crew that played basically drums on every major hit in the 60s.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Recorded in California. And Ventura Highway is just beautiful. Everything about it. And it's like I was saying with the counter melody, that and he's singing over. There's all these guitar melodies while he's singing a lead vocal, and it still works.
It's a beautifully crafted single, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I remember the first time I rode down Highway 101, And I was just like, this is the area. This is that place in California where, and it felt like that song. The air felt like that song. And it could have been just me projecting on it. But you know, a lot of that Laurel Canyon music feels like the canyon, and this feels like that to me. And so it's just such a moment. Don't Cross the River. I never really care for that one way or the other. It's fine. Only in Your Heart. Nice, sweet song. Again, I don't need it. I agree with you on the production. Muskrat Love, I don't dislike as much as you. I actually liked the Captain and Tennille version when I was a kid. I had the 45 and my friends made fun of me. You're supposed to be listening to Kissin' Queen. Yeah, well, I like this too. Tin Man is another one of the weird ones.
Yeah.
It's an odd song. A little pop song based on The Wizard of Oz, and that one of the characters didn't need anything because it's true.
Yeah, the philosophy of it, that he didn't already have.
Right, exactly. Lonely People, kind of odd, but neither here nor there. Sister Golden Hair, another perfect side, even if it is a George Harrison redux. It's a perfect pop song. Vague, nicely vague. You don't know why he didn't make it Sunday and got so damn depressed. But you know that there's something going on and everything is different now. And then the last line is just, I don't mind saying, I just can't make it. It's like it's like a conversation,
right? And then going into bop and doo wop,
right. Daisy Jane, neither here nor there, throw away from me.
Yeah, I agree.
Woman Tonight is bizarre because that's this very it's reggae-ish.
Yeah,
but I don't know if the normal non-music geek person can even find the one in that song because it's a weird, strange group. Yeah. So that song fascinates me from that regard, even without the lyric. So I like that. So this one, compared to the other ones, I like more of this than Rust Never Sleeps.
Really? Well, it's a greatest hit, so I don't know if that's a fair.
And that's an important thing to mention. Yeah. That's an important thing to mention, yes, because the next two albums are one way or another compilations. But as you said, it's all you really need. You Can Do Magic means something to both of us, but as an album, this is it. And this is history, America's Greatest Hits, as opposed to whichever the total greatest hits complete or whatever it was.
Yeah, that's the one. I have the complete greatest hits, which is an
exception. Yeah, which means we added one more song and a bunch of other songs.
Yeah, and most
that weren't actually hits. Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of them are throwaways, in my opinion.
Yeah, and that's why I was saying is if I guarantee you, if I was reviewing the album you listened to, it would be way down.
Right. Well, and I didn't. I focused on the ones that you had. So I just
as it is, I think I may have to give this one an A overall. Okay. Even as a greatest hits and acknowledging that, I'm not gonna knock a point down or give it an asterisk because I'm judging it as an album.
That's fair. Okay.
And I mean that's Venture Highway.
Yeah.
That alone.
Yeah. I mean you're
Mr. Golden Hair and A Horse with No Name.
You're not gonna get an argument out of me on Venture Highway for any stretch, because I love it. You know that. All right, sir, one album to go.
Album number 5.
All right, this one means quite a bit to Mr. McKay and myself personally, but we're try to be as objective as we can. Oh, yeah. I had the poster of that he's holding up the
yeah. For those of you listening on radio, I'm holding up the vinyl records on our Zoom meeting, and
I had it came with the poster of that, if I remember right. And I had that hanging on my wall. And
The poster was separate.
Oh, I had the poster. I also had the
tattoo, but it did not come with the record because they already had the Evolution of Kiss. They already had the tattoos.
Yeah.
They already had the combat gear order form. There would have been room.
And it's weird because I have no memory of the tattoos, but I remember that damn poster like it was yesterday.
The tattoos weren't in every copy.
Okay, so I may never even got the tattoos. I'm not sure. But I had the poster, and I remember thinking that was before I actually saw the band live. I remember thinking that's what it looked like. I didn't know until years later that when they shot the album cover, they just told the technical people just set off everything so we can get this shot.
Taking it a sound check.
Right, yeah.
For sure that never happened. Even the photo of Gene on the cover is a composite.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's several photos put together.
I remember trying to hide that from my mom.
Some moms definitely wouldn't have liked that.
Yeah. All right, you want to kick us off with this one?
Sure.
Okay.
All right, Kiss Alive 2. Let me look at this thing. And yes, it's to me, it's more of a piece of ephemera than anything else. Kiss is a love-hate thing for music geeks.
Absolutely.
That's fine. A lot of it comes from when you were where you came in your place and time, and you and I both hit exactly when we were their target audience.
Absolutely.
Or excuse me, we were their manager's target audience.
Their marketing department's target audience. Yeah.
Correct. This came out when I had just turned 8.
Mm-hmm.
So prime time. I had just gotten into Kiss earlier in the year. And in that time, they had released, you know, Rock and Roll Over was the first thing I heard. That was the new album. They had already released Love Gun since then. And now we're on Alive 2. And this is in the span of between the spring and November when this came out. And they released, what, six albums between 74 and 77. So it was bam, 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 bam. This would have been the six because they did three Alive, three, and then this. And remember, they tried to do a live album based on just songs from the previous three albums.
Right. I've noted
that it come out over just a year. Mm-hmm. The oldest song on this album was first released in March of 76. Mm. And this is November of 77 in a compilation.
Yeah.
So the album itself, it's hype. It's not even really live. You know, Alive One, at least the drums were live. This was recorded in the same sound in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. They marketed it for people to believe that it was recorded in LA at the Forum. Nah, yeah. It wasn't. Actually, excuse me. Beth was recorded live in Japan.
I think I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I think something else was recorded in Japan too. And I know some of the other tracks were recorded at sound checks. Like Tomorrow and Tonight, that was a sound check, I believe.
I don't even think it was a sound check. I think they actually recorded at the same sound stage when they were recording Love Gun in New Jersey.
Okay.
I think they actually just set up, recorded them like that. And you can actually hear, listen to I Want You. I Want You. You'll hear Paul, and then you'll hear Paul singing the backup.
Yeah, you hear multiple Paul Stanleys. Yes, I've noticed that.
So it's really obvious on a lot of it. Tomorrow and Tonight was never performed live, ever. What else was never performed live off this album? I guess that was the only one that was never performed live. Hard Luck Woman was performed like two or three times total.
Right.
So it's not a live album. And it's certainly not Alive 2, because the first Alive was also not fully live. But it captures a moment. It's meant to capture the feeling of being at a Kiss show, which in the mid-70s, for our generation, was the pinnacle of all civilization and humanity.
Yes.
Go through the song list. If you know Kiss, you'll know them. If you don't, you won't. Detroit Rock City. Hard to argue with that as an opening song, even if it wound up being Gene Simmons introducing the band on the album too, which is a bit absurd. Actually, I think it's just Gene's voice saying Kiss. The You Wanted the Best is the Eddie guy, and then Gene didn't think he said Kiss strongly enough.
Right, yeah, and then
he dubbed his own voice.
Yeah, they dubbed it and kind of fused it together. That's true.
Yeah, Detroit, it's a solid rock song with Freddie's Dead bass line from Curtis Mayfield. Not judging the song, judging performances here in the King of the Nighttime World. Solid rock and roll, ladies' room, dumb mid-70s stuff that for our generation was like, what?
Yeah.
When we were kids trying to figure out sexuality and is there something that we're not quite getting here?
Yeah, I took it literally as a ladies' room, and I didn't understand why they were singing about a ladies' room.
and I remember the first time I saw the Kiss album cover, Rock and Roll Over, and my first thought was, that looks really cool, but what's that girl doing on the cover? And it was Paul. But that's what I mean. It opens up our minds as well. Making Love, great rock song, not done justice on this album, in my opinion. Love Gun, perfectly fine. Calling Dr. Love. I mean, it's all the songs you'd expect. Christine 16 was a current hit. Mm-hmm. Shock Me, Ace's first lead vocal, Hard Luck Woman. I remember hearing this live version the first time we played it with my best friend Michael Hallman, sitting in his house and laughing because it sounded wrong. Because Hard Luck Woman is a great pop single, the original.
Sure.
Which people don't give them credit for, because that song just sounds really good. If Rod Stewart did it would be considered a classic. And he wrote it for Rod.
Right.
Tomorrow and Tonight, solid rock song, tried to be a sequel to Rock and Roll Night, didn't work. I Stole Your Love, side three. Beth is the only one live, and ironically it has a taped backup for the band. It's just the lead vocal. But you hear the audience change, you hear all the squealing girls, that's Japan.
Right. Yeah, that's
the different audience.
It's almost like, it's almost the Cheap Trick Budokan crowd comes in.
it's exactly the same crowd. It's the same venue, I believe.
It is. You're right.
Yeah. Then God of Thunder edited I Want You with Paul's Robert Plant imitation and Shout It Out Loud, which ends better. The album, it's what it is. It's the live portion of it. There's a fourth side of studio stuff. This one is really impossible to judge fully on a musical level.
Okay.
Because it was an ad for something that we wanted, really, which was to be at a Kiss concert.
Right.
That's ultimately what it is. It was about owning it and being a part of something bigger than us at the time and feeling like we were in a club. So it's really hard to see beyond that. A lot of the songs on there I still love. I will never not love those songs. But there's not a single one on the live three quarters of the album that I feel like that's the version I want to listen to if I want to hear the songs.
I agree.
Side four, I will try to go through quickly. they were throwaways for the most part, except for Rocket Ride, which Ace claims the timelines don't necessarily always add up with a lot of things that these guys say.
Of course not.
But Ace says that that was supposed to be on his solo album, and that when Kiss demanded he have a song to sing lead on, he pulled that, and that's why they did New York Groove on a solo record, because that replaced the spot that would have been held by Rocket Ride. So that worked for Ace on both levels, even though that's another dumbass song that when you're an 8-year-old boy is awesome.
Yeah.
All American Man, I thought it was great when I was 8. When I look at it now as a songwriter, it's like, that's pretty lame.
Yeah.
But it feels right. It feels like 1977, 1978. It feels like that era in a beautiful way. Rockin' the USA is Gene cashing in, trying to sound that retro 50s thing.
Yeah.
And late 60s that was so big in the happy days, Laverne and Shirley era. Larger Than Life is like their first song of the 80s. And is Rick Derringer playing guitar on Larger Than Life?
I believe you're correct. It's either him or Bob Kulick, but I believe it's Derringer.
Bob is on All American Man.
Yeah.
For sure. And I don't think Rockin' the USA has a solo. For some reason, I'm thinking that Larger Than Life had Derringer on there. And that's one of the most attitude-laden solos I've ever heard in my life, because Derringer didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
He knew he wasn't going to be credited. That's an ugly solo. And that drum part, people still say that's Peter Criss. That does not sound like Peter Criss to me.
Yeah.
I've never seen a credit that says differently, but that song is still kind of badass. I'm sorry.
Hmm.
It goes this really heavy, which is very pre-I Love It Loud. And then it goes into this Beatles chorus, where Paul's voice kind of takes over the harmonies. Rocket Ride, we've already discussed. Right. Ace said, why do you think Kiss never played it? Because they couldn't play the damn song. You think Gene could have played that bass part? That's me. So as far as I know, it's Ace and Peter on that song.
Yeah.
And Paul might have been singing some harmonies.
That's my understanding.
The Way You Want It, which they threw out, which was a Dave Clark 5 cover. Mm-hmm. I think they did a really good job of that, which again goes back to, like we were saying with Rockin' the USA, cashing in on the 50s, 60s thing.
Yeah.
Grade wise, I'll just give it a B and try to be honest overall and hear that. I have to do the opposite with this. I have to hear this as a critic.
Yeah.
As well as knowing that kid is still in there and seeing these photos.
I'm difficult like, oh,
look
to
how
do.
Cool Ace looks.
Yeah. And you open that inside cover and it's all over. I'm 8 years old again.
Oh, every time. Every time. Look at Gene's dragon. The tattoos. And this photo was what they even put in the fake Kiss song.
Oh, yeah, I have that. Yeah.
They digitally added that. It's not even from their show.
Well, of course, we were 8. We had no idea.
No, we didn't care.
And you're right. We wouldn't even cared if we did know. Who cared?
Oh, we would have fought over it.
Yeah. No way, man. That's real. Yeah. I remember getting that album home. And I mentioned to you earlier, my dad bought it for me. He's the only record he ever bought for me that I can recall. And I remember getting it home and I just stared at it.
You fetishized it.
I just stared at every aspect of it. The booklet that came inside, I read that front to back. I remember lying on my bed as a little kid and just going back and forth with that. So it is hard. It's hard to put those blinders on for this and just as a critic, because like you said, that the little boy that used to do that is still in here.
Yeah.
So it's hard to do. And
if you're non-Kiss fans, you will never, ever, 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 ever understand. We forgive you.
And that's why the people say, oh, I don't get Kiss, because you're listening to it as a grown man. You're not listening to it coming from as a boy, in the thick of it when it was red hot. But this was, as it turned out, kind of the last hurrah for Kiss in the original form. Because
really, if you can call it a hurrah, it was still pieced together. I mean, Love Gun is really the end.
But commercially, it sold well. So it was a hurrah.
Yeah.
I'm not saying artistically,
right? But they were splintered. But yes, it was the last where they were considered at their so-called peak. And then what? Well, it came out like a couple of weeks after Kiss. No, it was a year before Kiss Meets the Phantom.
Yes, so, it was.
Yeah,
because I saw them on the tour for this. I was 8 years old, and I saw them on December 22nd, 1977. I saw them. I was my very first concert. I was 8, and I was so jacked up for the show. I actually made myself ill. I had a fever that morning, and my mother was telling me, "Well, honey, you can't go if you're sick. I'll get better. I'll get."
That would be the peak time to see them. So you hit them right at the exact.
And I just remember we have like little Instamatic pictures of it somewhere. I saw them on that tour. Alive 2, it's bigger sounding, of course, than its predecessor, the original Alive, the classic Alive. Probably still my favorite Kiss album of all time is the original Alive. That's just me. But it's also not as fun as the original Alive, to me anyway. when you listen to the original, it sounds like a Hungry Band's studio enhanced or not. And of course, we know it was. But it sounds like a Hungry Band really trying to really on their way, or at least hopefully being on their way. Whereas Alive 2 sounds like a band who's on top and they know it. They know they're on top. So they can, by then, it seemed this album has more of a paint by numbers approach to the songs. Whereas the original Alive, they rearranged things, they added parts, they took pieces from abandoned songs and tacked them onto this one, to existing ones. This one's just more like, let's, you know, bang out the hits or bang out the songs from the record. You mentioned that the intro, the now classic, you wanted the best, you got the best. You're right. Gene did enhance that with the kiss at the end. It was the late Eddie Melendez, I believe his name was.
Oh, right. Eddie. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He did that. And then Gene and Eddie Kramer did some work on it and made it more sinister sounding, I guess.
Right.
But boy, does that get your attention? It certainly got my mom's attention when I was 8. Yeah, but they pump out the set list and just kind of like machine gun fashion. The song tempos are all quicker than the albums.
Way quicker, yeah.
But they're way quicker, but they're still not as quick as, you know, has a lot of 80s bands in the 80s did, where everything was just rapid fire.
Like Kiss.
Kiss was the prime example when Eric Carr was in the band. Yeah. Everything was so damn fast. But even on this, God of Thunder almost seems like it's played at double time from the
record. Yeah, it wouldn't have worked live with a young audience with that boom.
The plodding. You're probably right. And we
without
get
the fake studio stuff.
We get the obligatory Peter Criss solo for what it was. I'm as big an Ace Frehley fan as anybody. And I mentioned, I don't know if we were on the air or not, but I mentioned that Ace was my guy when we were kids. He was my hands down my favorite. And I get why they turned the microphone over to him because he was starting to write songs and starting to sing. But for the life of me, considering how overdubbed this is, or even just studio recreated, that vocal on Shock Me, I can't fathom that they couldn't have gotten a better vocal, even out of Ace, than that one.
Have you seen Ace live recently?
I've seen him live over the years, and live is one thing, but like we said, a lot of this was manufactured in the studio. So I just, for the life of me, I don't know why they use this vocal take, because it's not good at all. Even by Ace standards, it's not good. You know, he was unquestionably the weakest singer of the original four, but he was capable of a competent studio vocal, as he proved over the years. I don't know how much tweaking is involved in that.
Right.
You know, take that word for what it is. But his guitar solo is really the showcase for the Alive 2 version. That's really what it was.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Even though I still prefer the one from She, from the original Alive, that's I still prefer that. But the showcase here for Shock Me being on the record is A, to showcase Ace. Ace is singing now, and here's his badass solo.
And to showcase that he's doing hammer-ons a year before the Van Halen album came out.
Yeah, that's right.
And I was like, dude, you need to work in some hammer-ons.
This young guy's doing all this stuff. You gotta start doing it. I think you mentioned the live version of Hard Luck Woman that you and your friends...
Yeah, we just thought it was funny. It just sounded silly.
Because I wrote down some notes about that. They're not interested in the delicacies of the studio version here. They just hammer it out on electric guitars. But, you know, no one really cared at the time. So... But yeah, give me that the studio version any day. I agree with you that there's nothing here that I consider a definitive version of whatever song you're talking about. I'll always, for this album. Now, I can't say that about the original Alive.
Oh yeah, Alive 1, Deuce, Strutter,
yeah,
Black Diamond, 100,000 Years, Rock and Roll, and like most of those are the definitive versions.
Exactly. So. Give me those all day long. I completely agree. You also mentioned the live version of I Want You with the multiple Paul voices that come in there. But I do like I Want You here because this album doesn't have nearly as much of the quote unquote crowd interaction as the original Live. There's no 100,000 Years breakdown with Paul talking to the audience. This has the closest I think we get on this album with just the I want thing. And I kind of like that because it brings it a little bit more interactive as a live album rather than
they needed something.
Right. We're just banging out the hits, you know, to a canned applause. As for the 5 studio tracks, well, I agree with that. I actually wrote down the word forgettable. I think you use that. I also highlighted Rocket Ride as the best of the bunch. All American Man, if I had to choose a next best, that would be my next. I agree with you. I liked it when we were kids. Looking back at it now, not nearly as much. I do like that it has the swagger to it. There's a swagger to that.
Well, something like that, and the bend that Kulik does,
right?
Where he grabs the guitar string and pulls it up from the top.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that part is awesome.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But that's Bob Kulik, not a member of Kiss.
Right. Never officially, but play it on a bunch of their stuff.
Yeah.
But the less said about Rockin' in the USA, the better. I need to revisit Larger Than Life because I think you like it more than I do. Maybe I'm missing something.
Well,
there.
when I was a kid, when I first heard it, it was a freak. It was an anomaly because it was like, what? This is really heavy and kind of, this is not Kiss, but it's pre I Love It Loud. Listen back to it and listen to that drum part, especially. That's insane.
Mm-hmm. But overall, I think this is a worthy sequel. I think I think what you were trying to say, and it's probably dead on. It is more of a marketing marketing product than an artistic one. I think it was also meant to give them a break. Just like you mentioned how many albums they had pumped out between 76 and late 77. I think it was meant to give them a break. I'm sure there was already internal turmoil in the band, and
they were already working on Kiss Meets the Phantom and the solo album.
Well, yeah, and that's true. And whatever.
And double platinum came out, you know, this came out in November and double platinum came out in April.
So. Right. And what other, you know, excesses were going on with at least half of the band at the time were probably already pretty well entrenched. Oh, but yeah. I think it's a worthy sequel. But while the original Live seems to, even to this day for me, it seems to jump out of the speakers and invite me to a rock and roll party. Rock and roll party tonight. This seems to just want to hammer the party into my head for a lot of ways. I also gave it a B. I think you gave it a B and I gave it a B as well.
You know what? I'm going to revise my listing and make it a B minus.
Okay.
Not to disagree with you, but the more I'm talking about it and looking at it, I was like, I'm going to say, but now if we're talking about packaging, we got to reevaluate.
All right. Yeah. Well,
overall, I'm going to stick with a B minus on this. Yeah. And here you hear us waxing rhapsodical about how much this was, how important it was to us. But if I'm looking at it in an overall level with all things considered, I think I've got to reevaluate on that.
And okay. Just you can take it down a half notch.
To really be fair. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, that concludes our five albums. Thank you, Mr. Chris McKay, for joining us.
Thanks, Eric.
All right. If you're listening from the Hound Dog Radio podcast, if you want to know more about Chris McKay, I actually interviewed Chris back in August, and we did a pretty deep dive interview. And Chris is a fantastic musician in his own right, also top-notch photographer. We talk about both of those things in the interview, and it's worth your time to give it a listen. We play some of Chris's music in between our interview segments. All good stuff. Check it out. You can probably find it wherever you're listening to this as an earlier episode from August. Chris, thanks again, my friend.
Thanks, Eric.
We'll be talking to you soon.
Take care.